A couple of years ago, Eric Schlosser wrote a book called Fast Food Nation, all about the world of the fast food industry and how they make what they make and how they make the money that they make and the inside workings of everything from the individual local franchisee in their restaurant to the largest corporations in the world like McDonald's and Burger King and all the rest. Now there is kind of a follow-up to that book, which is aimed at a younger audience. Eric Schlosser wrote it with Charles Wilson, who joins me today. The book is called Chew on This, Everything You Don't Want to Know About Fast Food. Charles, welcome to KMOX.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure having you on here. You did aim this book at kind of preteens. My daughter is 12 years old. This book is aimed at her, isn't it?
It is. It is. And that's what I think Eric and I were reading, you know, after Fast Food Nation had come out, and we're reading statistics. You know, the CDC had said that, you know, one in three kids born in 2000 will develop type 2 diabetes. And, you know, in some ethnic subgroups, that could be as high as two in three. And we saw, like, also with the rate of obesity in the last 30 years among young people, ages 6 to 11, it's tripled, and teens, it's doubled. And so we thought, we were trying to figure out a way that we could sort of reimagine the book and try to bring it to a younger audience, high schoolers who are reading Fast Food Nation. But we thought, you know, could we target this to the same people that the industry is heavily targeting?
And you think that the fast food industry targets preteens?
It definitely does. If you look back, even the earliest business model of how these chains started, one of the things that I found while researching this was that Dick McDonald, who was one of the original McDonald brothers, and Ray Kroc, who was the founder of the McDonald's chain, they would correspond with each other via these sort of recorded messages. And Dick McDonald sent one thing to Ray Kroc where he said, my brother and I have been noticing that literally dozens and dozens of parents have been coming into our restaurant saying that they deliberately drive two or three blocks away from the restaurant, even if it's on their path, in order to keep their kids yelling for a hamburger and a milkshake. And Dick said, well, this, it's a sort of a dreamer's paradise, he said, and it got us to thinking that, you know, more attention should be devoted to this youngster business. And Kroc sent his own message back saying, this is a great idea. Let's send, you know, lollipops to kindergartens. Let's you know, target young kids in schools, at Little League, church groups. And so this industry saw really early on, the founders of the industry saw that you could bring a whole family into a restaurant by targeting a child directly. And that was really a new business model with restaurants.
But, you know, if that's the bottom line here, though, shouldn't the book be called Mom and Dad Have to Learn the Word No?
But that's it. You don't always want to be the parent who says no all the time, which is the, I think it puts parents in a difficult position because you don't want to be the nerd parent or the parent that's always the one denying, you know, your kid's pleasure. And I think it sets up a weird family dynamic in a way. And that's what we're trying to encourage, I think, young people to say, you know, here's what they're doing to you. They're tricking you, you know, and they're really spending a lot of money on trying to make you want this food. And you know, maybe you can think differently. And so that I think that's sort of the whole approach.
Okay, but you use the phrase all the time. You don't want to say no all the time.
Right.
You don't have to say no all the time. Isn't the real lesson that should be learned here moderation?
I think so.
I mean, if I take my kid to get some McDonald's French fries, which she loves, mm-hmm. and she has them once or twice a week, what am I doing something wrong? I know that there are families in this country who supposedly can't help but have 25 meals a week at McDonald's and Burger King and Wendy's and Steak and Shake. I don't know who these people are or how they can afford it, but apparently these people must exist because that's where the stories come from.
Well, I think if one thing is that the industry, one person, a McDonald's executive that I talked to, said that there's an 80-20 rule at the company, and that means that they get and so at some restaurants, they get 80% of their money from 20% of their customers. So these people are the people who are coming four or five, six times a week, not, you know, having a little bit of fries every week. But I would argue, even for like a young person, the McDonald's fries are full of, you know, trans fats, which are with this, you know, the worst kind of fat. And the CDC has said that the recommended daily amount of that is zero. And McDonald's has pledged for years to get this fat out of the oil, and they've yet to do it. And so I would say for kids, you know, but I would recommend that they don't go there at all.
But there's all sorts of stuff, Charles, that right. technically isn't good for you,
right.
that if you have every once in a while, is in the long run going to be part of a balance in your life, isn't it?
It's not going to kill you. And that's what I think, to have it every once in a while. But at the same time, I think that This isn't a balance that a lot of kids are getting, and this is a food a lot in a lot of inner city communities that people are eating, you know, most of the week, and so these are the people that, you know, we're worried about. And I think also, like, with cheap processed foods in the supermarket as well, there's trans fats there, so it's not only fast food, but I think at the same time we're hoping, you know, kids will make better decisions to taper back.
Are you saying that the kids have to make better decisions because the parents are incapable of making that better decision?
No, I think it has to be something that's...
Because in my house, it's the parents who have the money and the car.
Right. Well, I think what we're hoping with a book like this is that you have... so you sort of reverse the technique of pester power, where, you know, pester power, as far as how the advertisers use it, they get the kids to pester their parents for a product or to have fast food. We're hoping, you know, like, that kids that read our book will talk to their parents and say, you know, hey, did you know that a pre, you know, McNugget chicken only lives 40 days, and it's, you know, and it's a really obese chicken, and they've figured out a way to engineer it in such a way that it grows really fast, but is not good for them, and you know, for the chickens, doesn't really enjoy its life, or, you know, or hey, do you know?
Well, let me just stop you right there.
Sure. Okay.
Most people listening right now are going to say the following. I don't care. It's delicious.
I know. I think if you think about it, like, I think most people, you know, you're confronted with this in fast food, these things that are wrapped up in like a present, you know, and it's really shiny and happy, but you never, I don't think most young people ever think about, you know, where did this animal come from that's supplying this, you know, and so and whether it'll affect kids' choices, you know, ultimately, I don't know. But I think it's also good to think about, and to think about every dollar that you spend. It's a little bit like a vote, and you're endorsing the kind of practice that, and this industry is really responsible for the industrialization of agriculture as we know it. And I think that's something, you know, that kids should think about.
I heard Eric say when he was promoting the Fast Food Nation book, mm-hmm. that one thing you don't know about most hamburgers in this country is that when you get a hamburger, not all the meat in that hamburger came from one cow. It could have come from dozens, hundreds, or even 1,000 different cows.
That's right. I think that's what I think most people don't know that.
But again, mm-hmm. who cares?
Right. Well, I think that who cares, the reason I think to care about that is that the potential for contamination is so much greater. And what essentially this industry is, you know, it's helped to create a meatpacking system that's consolidated greatly. So you have these plants where 400 cattle are being slaughtered an hour, where all the meat is passing through the same grinders, and you get, yeah, on a microscopic level, you could get pieces of hundreds of thousands of cattle. The problem with that is that you have one cow there infected with E. coli or some other bug, is that it potentially can contaminate a lot more burgers. And one of the things the meat industry, you know, attacked Eric for, saying our meat supply is safe and this is nothing to worry about. And then the same meatpacking plant that he wrote about, in the ConAgra meatpacking plant, had a recall of 18.6 million pounds of beef in 2002 after he wrote the book. And the reason why, instead of just recalling, like, you know, a few pounds as he would back in the butcher's days, is that this meat is all passing through the same, you know, geographical area, and it's hard to tell which part can be contaminated or not. And so it's not to say that everyone should panic about their burger, and it's not, you know, but at the same time, the potential for something bad going wrong is much greater.
It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX, talking with Charles Wilson, co-author with Eric Schlosser of Chew on This, Everything You Don't Want to Know About Fast Food. And I should say, we invited spokespeople from the food industry to join us on the show today. Several different groups we contacted, they all declined to come on here, although I'm guessing after we're done, I'll hear from them by email and they'll demand equal time. And I'd be more than happy to offer them that. And I'll ask them tough questions like I'm trying to ask you here today.
That's
but I also want to give you the opportunity to talk about some of the things that you discovered in your research, such as flavor factories. What are those?
Well, I don't think most people realize that. I guess when you process a food as heavily as we do today at fast food restaurants, you ultimately, you know, destroy a lot of the flavor, the natural flavor that those foods already have. And so this vast industry in along mostly the New Jersey Turnpike arose to sort of correct this problem. And this sort of reflavors your unflavored food that's been unflavored through processing. And so, but it's mostly done by these very, very smart chemists who mix literally dozens or hundreds of chemicals together to create something that tastes like, you know, a strawberry in your strawberry milkshake, or tastes like what you think a fresh grilled burger should taste like. And And so, and it's not necessarily harmful, these chemicals, though I think we have so many of them in our food system today that it's sort of a weird cocktail of all sorts of different chemicals that people didn't eat 30 years ago. But at the same time, it's a little weird.
And what goes into some of these flavor additives?
Well, I think if you think about a strawberry milkshake, I don't think many people would realize that probably the red dye in your strawberry milkshake, this is not a flavoring, but...
It
comes from bugs.
Yeah.
Harvested in Peru.
And not just in strawberry milkshakes, but all red dye comes from that, doesn't it?
It's true. Most red dye. There are some red dyes that don't use it, but usually if you have red dye, in your strawberry yogurt or in even pink grapefruit juice that maybe is just not quite pink enough for the company that's making it, then often they have these ground up little bugs. Yeah. And then in the juice.
But again, there are some people who go, ooh, I don't want bugs in my juice.
Mm-hmm.
But I think most people would say, okay, you're giving me something that tastes good and is pleasing to the eye, and I enjoy it, and it's not bad for me in moderation. Fine, that's okay with me.
But in a sense, it's not with kids, I think, in particular. It's not really a fair fight, because I think kids, they often develop their preference of what they think a strawberry tastes like. They develop that by, chewing Bubblicious bubble gum or having a fake strawberry milkshake. And when they have a real strawberry, which has like a little bit of bitterness in it, they're already ill-disposed toward it because their first experience of the flavor is the sweet stuff. And that's what the flavor companies do. Is they find, especially with kids' foods, they find ways to up the sweetness and to remove the bitterness, which kids don't like. But at the same time, kids will eat whatever they are accustomed to eat when they're very young. And so the fact that we're doing this, it really sort of puts, I think, the kids in an unfair position not to like foods that they might learn to like otherwise.
Charles once worked rounding up beef cattle on his uncle's ranch. How did that compare to what goes on the average ranch these days, Charles?
Well, it's very different, and that's what I think. My uncle had he's an independent rancher, and he had about 300 head of cattle spread out over a huge acreage. And today, we're seeing a steady decline in the number of independent ranchers in this country, and also you see a lot of depression and suicide amongst ranchers as well, and a lot of them are getting pushed off the land in the same way other people are by, increasing suburbanization and other pressures. I mean, and with the consolidation of the meatpacking industry, too, what you've seen is that the cattle, they often begin on independent ranches, but then they go for the last months to be what they call finished off at these huge feedlots and where they feed them grain, and cattle are used to eating, grass. And so this is very hard on their stomachs. They grow at an incredibly fast rate very quickly. And these feedlots are right next to often the slaughterhouses so that the cattle, once they're at their prime, can be slaughtered right there. So it's a very different system than even 20, 30 years ago with the consolidation of the industry.
All right, another thing I wanted to talk about with you today is working at fast food restaurants, which I did. Summer of 1976, I was a stupid little punk high school kid and took a job working at a McDonald's and worked the breakfast and lunch shifts. It was like 6 in the morning till 2:30 in the afternoon, 5 days a week, and making minimum wage. But it's one of those entry-level jobs that many teenagers, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think the fast food industry is the number one employer of teenagers in this country. Is that right?
It might be, and also the number one low-wage employer in this country. That's
okay, but I want to read a paragraph from your book, Chew on This.
Mm-hmm.
The strict rules at fast food restaurants help to create food that always tastes the same. They help workers fill orders quickly, and they give fast food companies an enormous amount of power over workers. When all the knowledge is built into the operating system and the machines in the kitchen, a restaurant no longer needs skilled workers. It just needs people who are willing to do as they're told. Workers who lack skills can be hired cheaply. Instead of celebrating individual talent, the system seeks workers who are interchangeable. It seeks workers who can be easily hired, fired, and replaced.
Mm-hmm.
Now, everything you say in that paragraph is true.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I ask you, what's wrong with that?
I think it's an abandonment of a long tradition of labor history in this country.
Well, wait a second. Let's go back to Henry Ford and the assembly line. Isn't that the same thing he was doing?
Yes, but he also paid his workers better than anyone else had paid industrial workers before. And then this industry pays more of the minimum wage to a larger group of workers than ever before. And I think it's abandoning also the sort of the sense, especially with young people, of mentorship. I think when your first job, and this is not necessarily true of everybody, and I understand, and I don't mean to be pejorative about these jobs at all, because I think people need them, and I think they can teach skills as far as, you know, I think, you know, getting to work on time, working as part of a team, and people often go on to other things, as you've done, and a good example of that. But at the same time, I think that this industry has increasingly tried to mechanize everything to where the industry involves no training at all and no sense of mentorship, too. You know, I think as far as, like, helping young people, you know, to go on to something further and being part of, you know, teaching them a skill that they can use later besides those basic things. And so I think it's very different than Henry Ford in a large way. And so
I think there are differences, and there are things about the current fast food industry that drive me crazy. You know, most people who work those registers, they don't have to do math, and they can't do math. Everything's, you know, they don't even have to look for the name of the item. They look for the picture, cheeseburger, Big Mac, whatever it is. And then the register does all the work for them, and it literally is mindless work. But the difference to me is, you know, the people who were there at the first few years of a automobile assembly line, they were starting careers as automotive workers, which you could do for your life.
Right.
Who wants to be the fry guy at Steak and Shake for the rest of their life?
Well, but if you see at some other restaurants, people do stay longer. And so we do mention a couple of good examples. In the West Coast, there's an In-N-Out Burger, in which they start their workers at $10 an hour. They're provided benefits. And you see people there, the turnover rate, you know, which most restaurants or a lot of fast food restaurants is, you know, 250% or higher than 200%. There, people stay 10, 11, 12 years. And so certainly, I think, you know, a high school kid, a lot of them, you know, it is a first job. It's the employer first resort. And I think that, you know, for some kids, I think it can be an okay thing, you know. But I think on the whole, this industry has recognized that it can exploit young workers who are still working at home, I mean, still living at home, and who don't need to pay rent, and can pay them very little. And they don't necessarily, they can still make a profit and treat their workers better.
I'm guessing when Burger King comes out with the BK Stacker, 4 hamburger patties, 4 slices of cheese, and 4 strips of bacon, 1,000-calorie sandwich, that drives you crazy. Or when our friends at Hardee's come out with something like the Philly Cheesesteak Thick Burger, which is pretty much, you know, everything you'd expect it to be, and then their sales go up, that probably drives you crazy.
Right. I think, you know, adults, you know, it is America after all, and adults, you know, if they want to buy a Monster Thick Burger, by all means, they should buy a Monster Thick Burger. I think that, you know, with kids, I think we feel like they're not necessarily in a position to make, you know, the best choice. And so I think particularly as far as we just want these companies to be very, very circumspect about how they advertise to young people. But you have seen the industry has continued to make money by, you know, making bigger and bigger burgers, and that's really they've found that health doesn't sell, you know, and so I think, you know, we're like just a little small voice in the wilderness, and, you know, they spend $10 million on television advertising every day, you know, and our budget for our whole book is, you know, a small tiny percentage of that for the whole book. And so I feel like this is something, it's good to get out there and talk about. And I think Eric's book created a public debate about these issues that wasn't really there before. And so I feel like in time, and hopefully incrementally, and by talking to young people directly, that they can make a change in the future.
Do you want the government to get involved?
Not. I'm not one that I want the government involved in portion sizes or anything to that degree. I think there are things that they can do. I think I'm encouraged that maybe the minimum wage might be raised. This industry has, you know, fought that for years and years. I think with trans fats, it is the most, you know, it's the most toxic thing in the American diet. It's full of it at KFC, at McDonald's. You know, you can have a meal at KFC with 15 grams of trans fat. Trans fats alone cause 200,000 heart attacks a year, according to the New England Journal of Medicine. I think the FDA could ban trans fats, as Denmark and other countries have done. And the fast food companies got rid of the trans fats there because they had no choice. But I am not one for, like, I don't believe in excessive government regulation, but I think there are things the government can do better and subsidize also better, healthier foods, as opposed to subsidizing corn, which goes into so much of our sweet stuff in America.
Yeah, it's also going to go into our gas tanks, though, so you're not going to lose. You're not going to win that battle.
No, I believe in the electric car, but that's a whole other issue.
Yeah, I do, too, but unfortunately, we're not there yet. And I agree with you on the minimum wage. I just think that the recent movement about it on Capitol Hill has been all politics and no actual solutions.
Well, they sort of pulled off a trick there by linking also the getting rid of the estate tax at the same time.
And yeah, you notice they don't want to link it to their own salary increases, but that's another topic
for
another day. Do you want legislation to ban things like kids' clubs?
I think that'd be very tricky to do. I think what we can do is we can set nutritional standards, just like we have with the National School Lunch Program. You know, you set certain nutritional standards with that where it has to meet. It can't just be totally empty calories. I think we could set with advertising, like food to children. There are, like, thresholds that we could set as far as if you are advertising a food to kids, it has to have meet certain nutritional standards.
But I got to tell you, have you spent any time in an elementary or middle school cafeteria?
I have.
Okay. This was my experience. Tell me if it matched yours.
Uh-huh.
There's not a lot of eating going on. I mean, it doesn't matter whether they bring the food from home or they're getting it in the cafeteria line. You can give them 15 minutes or you can give them 45 minutes for lunch. There's just not a lot of eating going on. There's way more talking and fun and a break from their schoolwork. Yeah. And it doesn't matter whether the kid goes to the salad bar and gets a salad plate or gets the, whatever it is with the green beans on the side or brings in a sandwich and Twinkies from home. Most of the food isn't being consumed there.
Well, I saw a lot of kids, because the school lunches are so bad, too, I think I agree with you. I saw the same thing a lot of places. I think, but because, like, the quality of the food being served at the cafeteria is so bad, a lot of the kids, they either eat, like, Skittles or something out of the school store, or they'll just skip the meal altogether, or they'll just eat a little bit, and then save their larger meal for later in the day. And so I agree to a large part, but what I saw is that you have the school store with all the junk food competing directly with the school lunches, which are often, the kids don't like very much.
Yeah, well,
and now, too, with the a la carte options with fast food, and also we talk in the book, there's 19,000 public schools that serve brand-name fast food in the cafeteria. The kids that can afford that, go for that at the expense of the National School Lunch Program.
Yeah, because you're not going to have enough broccoli and asparagus in the world to compete against a slice of Pizza Hut pizza.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult, especially when once kids, taste are formed in that degree. And that's what I really believe in. Some schools have been some innovative things where they've involved, like, the lunch people who work on the lunch staff in the nutrition education. I think if kids see that the most poorly paid people in the whole school are the cafeteria workers, and they have the lowest morale, and the food is crap, I think kids are going to get an idea, like, even if you're teaching them a nutrition class, this is healthy, I think they're going to get more of an idea of what the value we put on food when they see that than whatever you're telling them in nutrition. And so I really feel like this is a system it's a huge task, but that needs to be revamped. And there's some positive examples here in New York and Harlem. There's a school that's trying to incorporate the lunch people into the curriculum and create healthier meals. And so it can be done.
I'm not sure there's enough money in the world to make the lunch lady happy when she has to make 200 Salisbury steaks. I know that the restaurant industry, particularly the fast food restaurant industry, has not taken things sitting down. What are some of the things that they've done in response to what you've written?
Well, McDonald's issued a very, I thought, benign and fair public statement about our book, saying that it sort of welcomes debate and that, enlisting several, positive things that they feel the company's done that haven't got noticed, which is fine. But at the same time, I guess they pay this Washington lobbying group called DCI Group, and they specialize in what essentially are, fake grassroots campaigns. And so before the book came out, we started to get attacked by all these groups with these very nice-sounding names that we'd never heard of before, like the Heartland Institute and the National Minority Health Month Foundation the American Council on Science and Health. We believe in, we strongly believe in the heartland. We believe in minority health. We believe in science and health. And
so you found yourself being attacked by these, and you went, hey, what did we do?
I know. Well, certainly, I think at the same time, we're writing a book very critical about the industry. We expect to be attacked, but we'd like to be attacked directly by the people who we're being critical of. And instead, what this did was create this sort of false sense of a grassroots effort against the book, which is actually orchestrated by corporate interests and by the National Restaurant Association and so forth. And so we're glad to have a debate. We're glad to have people be critical of the book, but some of the ways that the attacks were orchestrated was very, I think, underhanded.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, we invited spokespeople from the food industry to join us here today. They declined. That's their loss.
Yeah, and that's what we'd be glad, and I'd be glad any time to debate them, or also if they come on your show and they present their point of view, and that's what this is all about. I mean, they get their point across every single day. They spend $3 billion on television advertising every year. They shouldn't be scared of someone who might have a different point of view.
Is there anything you would eat at a fast food restaurant?
I certainly don't begrudge McDonald's and the other restaurants adding healthier menu choices. And I think, you know, they have salads, and I think if you don't slather it in you know, too much of a high fat dressing, that it is a better choice. And so certainly if kids in a lot of people are in neighborhoods where it's very hard to eat elsewhere. And in that case, you know, encourage people to make the healthiest choice that they can at a fast food restaurant when they're there. So we're not telling kids what to eat in this book. We're just trying to show them sort of where their food comes from and have them make up their own mind.
Is there an economic factor involved in that decision?
There totally is, and that's the hardest thing, I think, to answer. And I think it's and you worry even writing a book that maybe you're not reaching, you know, the people who, you know, might need this message the most. But at the same time, you hope that this creates, you know, the kids talk amongst themselves about these issues, and this becomes part of how kids communicate to each other, and they can, you know, convey this to their friends, and so you hope, you know, it's like what Robert Kennedy called ripples of hope or whatever, is that by, you know, little actions that you can, in time, you know, change the world.
Well, I'll pass the book along to my daughter and see what her reaction is, and maybe it'll save me a couple of trips to the McDonald's drive-thru to get her some French fries.
I hope so.
Charles, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it, Paul. Thanks.
Charles Wilson, co-author with Eric Schlosser of Chew on This, Everything You Don't Want to Know About Fast Food. Of course, there is a link to the book on my website, harrisonline.com. This is News Talk 1120 KMOX.